Hello, everyone, and welcome to Talk Nerdy. Today is Monday, January 15th, and I'm your host, Cara Santa Maria. And I want to thank those of you who made Talk Nerdy possible this week, especially those of you who have pledged your support by going to patreon.com/talknerdy. That includes Stefan A., Phil Tiber, Timothy Glover, Pedro M. Rosario Barbosa, Jeffrey Perez, Charles Payet, Jonathan Wright, Christian Jeffrey, the Honorable Husband, Jafe, Gabriel Felipe Jaramillo Gonzalez, Brian Holden, and Jeffrey Sewell. If you would like to pledge your support for the show, just visit carasantamaria.com and follow the links. Also, how'd you guys like the new newsletter? First time. It was fun. It was fun to make, fun to send out. I should be doing one of those as a reminder, hopefully each week, for new episodes and maybe anytime there's something new going on in the world of Talk Nerdy. If you didn't get a newsletter, that means you didn't sign up for one. And if you would like to do so, you can go to carasantamaria.com and, you know, give me your info. I'll tell you about specials on things in the store and cool new calendar events and things like that. Excited about it. Really excited about it. New things in the new year, including a new episode of Talk Nerdy. Now, this one features Natalie Newell. She is the director and producer of Science Moms. It's a really great new documentary that I highly recommend you check out. It features a bunch of cool parents who are kind of fighting back against the anti-vax, anti-GMO, anti-science movements that I think have really taken a stranglehold on young parents across the country. Natalie is also the co-host of the Science Enthusiast podcast. And of course, after working for quite a long time in Montessori education, she is now a stay-at-home mom who really focuses a lot of her attention on science and secular activism. So without any further ado, here she is, Natalie Newell. Well, Natalie, thank you so much for joining me today.
I'm really happy to be talking to you.
I am too. You are one of the first podcasts of the new year. I'm going to try and time travel for a minute. I think I will have said this last week, but of course my laptop, I don't want to say it was stolen, but I think it was stolen. I left it on a plane and it vanished into thin air because of course American Airlines has yet to locate it, even though I told them the flight, the plane and the seat I was sitting in and exactly where they could go find it. Maybe it'll come back, maybe it won't, but I'm very glad that I was able to get everything back and going and we can record today. I'm so happy to be back online. Also, I've been having internet connectivity issues. Do you ever deal with that?
You know, I feel like I've been pretty lucky with internet stuff, but watch, later today, the entire internet in this entire city is probably going to go out because I just said that. That's totally how it works. But
I think that's
definitely how it works. But I'm glad that you're back in internet land so we can have this conversation and, you know, do our
Me
thing.
Too. So you're on the East Coast. We're 3 hours apart. Where are you hailing from?
So I'm in Bethesda, Maryland. So right outside of DC where it is really, really cold right now. And so, yeah. That's just depressing January life here right now.
Oh, yeah. We're in a brutal cold snap across the United States, like one of the coldest winters we've had in a really long time because, you know, climate change isn't real.
It's not.
There's snow.
There's snow. So there's no difference between weather and climate as it's been established by our president's Twitter account and stuff. So, yeah, climate change is not a thing because I am layering myself tremendously to go outside.
Gosh, that's terrible. I live in LA. We never have that problem. I feel really bad for people who do. But then again, sometimes I do miss it. I like it when I get to travel for work and see snow, but I also like that I get to fly back home, right?
Yeah, after. You get to just have the little reprieve, you know, like it's kind of nice and different, but then you get to go where it's warm all the time.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah.
Exactly. Well, anyway, I am really excited to actually talk to you about some of the really cool things that you've been up to lately. I am really, I don't know how to put it, like thrilled. I'm my heart overfloweth. It's the idea of the work that you and the other science moms are doing, I think, is really important. It's really timely and it's really necessary. So I think the first thing that we should just dive right into is, maybe you can tell me, what is a science mom?
Oh, what is a science mom? See, that's, I guess it's like, I've just been absorbed in this world of science moms, that do I have sort of the Webster's dictionary definition of what a science mom is. But, you know, science mom to me is this idea that we can be parents and also base our decisions on science and evidence and critical thinking in a world where, I mean, you see the internet and the wooey pseudoscience type of stuff that's geared at parents. So I feel like we needed an antidote to that.
Yeah.
And this science moms concept came to me just because there are a lot of brilliant women out there, scientists, science communicators, doing the work of putting a more evidence-based perspective out into the world of parenting. So, I mean, it's science moms, but I think it's a broader concept too of just people who want to be part of a movement to bring reason and critical thinking to the forefront, because we are just overrun with pseudoscience, I feel like.
Absolutely. And so the way that you guys do that is through multiple avenues, right? Like, you podcast, you write blogs, you even made a documentary recently.
Yeah. So I do the Science Enthusiast podcast with my friend Dan, who runs a really large, like, I think it's almost a million followers, Facebook page and blog called A Science Enthusiast. But I met Dan and started the podcast because I had begun this documentary project now it's over 2 years ago. The Science Moms documentary came about because I stumbled upon this open letter on the Grounded Parents parenting blog, written by the five women who are in my film, Coven, Allison, Jenny, Anastasia, and Layla. They wrote this letter, hashtagged it Moms for GMOs, and essentially wrote this open letter to celebrities like Gwyneth Paltrow, Sarah Michelle Gellar, all of those women that had jumped on the Just Label It bandwagon. And, you know, because GMOs are awful, right? And, you know, we need to be careful about what we're feeding our children. And, you know, this movement of doing things in the name of being a mom that the celebrities kind of took on, whether it was there was also the Jenny McCarthy type of anti-vaxxer mom movement too. But I came upon these women who were taking a different stand. And it's weird to think about now that I read this blog post just late one night while I was feeding my baby. And then in that moment decided, I want to make a movie about them. And then I just kind of did it. It's this weird, awesome thing for myself, I guess, that it was this idea that I had and have seen it all the way through. So to reflect on it now is sort of a holy shit, that happened type of thing.
So let's talk about the movie. Tell me all about it. You said you've been working on it, or you had been working on it, for close to 2 years. When did it first get released?
So it finally saw the sort of the light of day and was put in front of the eyes of an audience in just this past October. So October 2017 at QED in Manchester. So I got to show it to my skeptic friends first. And then the second time it was shown was at SciCon, where you were too, in Vegas.
Yeah.
So it was just this October that it was put out there. It's a short film, you know, featuring interviews with the five women I mentioned before, talking about issues like around food, kind of the organic, conventional type of issues, and GMO, non-GMO, alternative medicine, vaccines, all of that kind of stuff, but from, you know, through the lens of being a parent. So the film finally, you know, was put out there to, you know, audiences at some conferences, but then also released for download online. And it was really rad to see, you know, the first couple days, especially when I put the movie up online, and you know, people were watching it and emailing me and messaging the other women in the movie, just kind of giving the feedback of, you know, they're glad that this exists.
Oh, absolutely. So incredibly necessary.
Because I think we've seen films like GMO, OMG, and What the Health, and all these movies that promise to cure whatever ails you based on, I mean, pseudoscience. And based on these ideas that GMOs might be harming us and our children, or, you know, I mean, even taking it further, films like Vaxxed that aim to scare you into making some really dangerous and horrible decisions about your children's health. But it felt like maybe there was a space in the world for something that was a little bit different, a documentary that wasn't trying to, you know, sell fear, but instead say, hey, like, you don't need to be scared about everything, because there's, you know, evidence and scientific consensus that exists out there for a reason. There are experts that can actually, you know, give us credible information.
And so where can people find a copy of it? Like, people can watch this now, right? Like, it's available to download.
Yeah, they can watch it now. ScienceMomsDoc.com is the website for the film, and they can, you know, there's a link right there to download. And actually, you have to pay to get it. But what I want to give you after we do this is a code, so people that listen to this podcast can download it for cheaper. We'll do a Talk Nerdy download code. So
awesome. Oh, that's so great. Yay. I mean, and it's already really inexpensive though. Like, it's, you know, like, you look at the investment of $5 to learn what you can learn, and to, I don't know, just be a little bit more aware. I think the thing that really speaks to me and is so meaningful and important, and we were talking about this recently on the Skeptics Guide, is just that when it comes straight from the mouth of somebody who's been there. Like, I think a lot of times the skeptic movement, and it's not really their fault. Like, it's just being a white dude is not in and of itself like a criminal activity. But sometimes the problem is that the skeptics movement is really overrun by like older white dudes. And so sometimes it feels like for many people, there's not really a place for them in the movement, or maybe they feel like it's got a bit of a sort of patriarchal vibe to it. Like, oh, who are you to tell me how I should raise my family? Or who are you to tell me how I should think about these things? And so I think it's really important that there are, first of all, women, and second of all, women with children. I'm not one of those women. You know, I can sit here and pontificate all day about why it's important to vaccinate your kids, but I don't have kids. And so it does ring a little bit thinner coming from my mouth. And that's why I think it's so important that you guys are doing what you're doing, because you've been there and you've done that. And you can empathize with a mom who's scared of vaccines in a way that I think is harder for me to do.
Yeah. I mean, one of my sort of real life examples, because I have an almost 5-year-old and a 3-year-old. And, you know, some of these conversations that happen on, you know, the school playground at a school event or that kind of thing can be really meaningful, just because when you connect with someone for any topic, really, you connect with somebody on that common ground type of level, and, you know, have a conversation that might be about a tricky subject, but you find that common ground first, you can sometimes broach these subjects in a way that, I don't know, like you were saying, if it's just some old white dude telling the mom on the playground, you need to make this decision, it's a little different. I mean, this summer I had a conversation with a mom. I was just meeting her for the first time, and she was asking me, you know, the questions you ask when you make small talk, like, so what do you do? And I used to feel a little bit more hesitant to say, you know, oh, I do a podcast and I made this film about, you know, the topics that I cover, because it's controversial sometimes. You don't know how somebody is going to respond when you say, I made a pro-GMO, or, you know, essentially pro-biotechnology, pro-vaccine, pro-real medicine movie. And I also do a podcast where I talk about secular stuff and atheism. Like, all of that, I pretty much just throw out all of those topics, like which one of those might offend you. But I've kind of reached the point where I just put it all out there because, you know, you can Google my name and stuff would come up. But this particular mom asked me what I do. And I started mentioning the film and the podcast. And so she then just came out and asked me, she's like, so should I, like, what do you feel about vaccines? I don't know if I should get my child the flu shot. My family was not into vaccines. My husband's family says, yes, you should vaccinate the children. And she asked me, she's like, what do you think? And then we had a really good conversation just about, I talked about the film. I talked about the women in it, some of the reading that I had done, but I pretty much also said, you know, you can Google anything. I could Google anything, you know, ask a question and come up with, you know, any answer really, but talk to your doctor. Do like have those kind of conversations, because don't just listen to me, the mom on the playground who happened to make a movie about this stuff, but, you know, talk to an actual health professional. But the thing that was really kind of cool that happened was the next time I saw this particular mom at another school event, she came up to me and said she got her kids the flu shot. So it's those conversations where, you know, you're not going to necessarily change somebody's mind about this stuff, you know, with one conversation or anything like that. But I feel like the science mom's work and just the work that any of us do, make, like, you know, you making podcasts and doing, and like what Skeptics Guide does, it's planting the seeds of critical thinking about, you know, it could be about a particular topic, but the hope is that it crosses over to, you know, just how somebody kind of views the world. And that with parents, it's like, if we can have these conversations first as, you know, just two people who are also moms and share concerns, then we can maybe get somewhere with some of these issues. And it's not about talking at somebody, it's talking with them.
So do you think that, like, what are some of the biggest topics that you find moms, especially young moms, do struggle with sort of under that skeptic umbrella? Because I remember reading a piece that just came out maybe within the last week, a study about how the vast majority of online anti-vax bloggers are women. Like, it's like heavily dominated by younger women. Is it really the vaccines and the GMOs that are like the two big topics that you guys are really trying to fight against? Or do you find that there are a lot of other smaller things that are important?
Well, those definitely are two topics that I encountered, you know, that I've encountered both sort of in the online world since I started working on, you know, the film and the podcast and all of that. But I remember being taken aback by other things, like when my, before any of this started, before I got into, you know, doing the filmmaking and podcasting, I was, I worked in education. I was a Montessori school teacher and then a school director for 5 years. So I was essentially a preschool principal for a while. But when I had my first son, he was crying one day and a mom came up to me and suggested that I take him to a chiropractor.
Oh my God. And did you know at the time, like, were you already a pretty skeptical thinker?
Yes. Yes. And my mom is, she's a retired nurse. And so I've always been very fortunate that I come from I just want to say sort of rationally thinking family, especially about the health related issues. I mean, my mom is just as pro vaccine as you can get. So I never really fought my own internal battles about to do this or not, but yeah, so I was already a fairly skeptical mindset when this mom just came up to me and, you know, she was a parent of a child who went to the school that I worked at. So in a sense, she was a client of mine at this small private school that I wanted to keep. So you have to use a lot of self-control when somebody essentially comes up to you and says about your 6-month-old child, you should, what, have somebody crack his back?
How is that even legal that chiropractors can do that?
I know. So I had to stand there and she makes this suggestion and I just said, I'm okay. No, thank you. And I just had to kind of walk away from that because, I mean, I wasn't going to go into a whole rant, but, and now if somebody suggested that to me, it would probably be a little bit of a harsher response because I didn't realize just how off, like, I mean, I knew it was bad, but I didn't realize how gnarly and awful it really is, you know? But it was things like that, that those experiences stuck with me. And so it was like that kind of thing that just was a, oh my goodness, people actually do this, to then the other parents that would come up to me when they knew that I had just had a child and ask me if I was going to vaccinate on schedule because maybe I should, you know, do some Googling or watch this movie or something because, you know, the reasons people give, too many too soon and vaccines cause autism and whatever. Those were thrown at me.
That's a big argument that they make, right? It's like you have the hardcore anti-vaxxers who basically say, don't vaccinate at all. And that's like an extra brand of dangerous. But then you have the people who are like, I'm not anti-vaccination. I just think we give too many too close together. I just think you should wait or you should space them out, which in a way is just as dangerous because if the kids don't get their vaccines in time and they get sick, they might as well have never had them.
Right. And so that argument just never sat well with me. And I happened to find a wonderful pediatrician's practice that I, you know, still take both of my kids to. It's actually a pediatrician's office. It's made up of all women doctors who are just, I remember going, you know, you get to go when you have kids and you get to go and like meet the pediatricians beforehand. I guess you're kind of just figuring out what doctor you want to take them to. And I remember at the little info session for this practice, they said to all of us that were there, they essentially said, we want to vaccinate your children. So if you are going to fight that, we might not be the practice for you. And I was sold. I was just, sign me up for this one because I was just fortunate to have that. But the too many too soon argument, I mean, they brought that up. I remember at the pediatrician's office that's not an evidence-based reason to delay vaccines or whatever. There's a YouTuber I really like, Concordance, who's done this fantastic video about the too many too soon argument and how it isn't a credible argument.
Yeah, it's just sort of like somebody had an idea once that if you space them out more, it's healthier with like absolutely no medical or scientific backing. And now people really glom onto that.
Yeah, they definitely do. And so that was something that was brought to me just as a parent when, you know, just the person who knows I just had a baby is asking me these questions. So I do think that there's the alternative medicine and vaccine related issues with parents. Then there's the food issues also, which I saw a good deal in my job in education too. I remember parents coming to me and asking if we could require only organic foods be served as snacks at the school. And I mean, I just gave them a hard no on that one because parents would take turns sending in snack food for the class. And there was no way I was going to request that parents spend significantly more money on top of the tuition that they're already paying just to feed the children organic food.
Which, again, has no evidence to show that it is in any way healthier. And if anything, it's more likely to spoil faster. It has a lower shelf life generally. And it's more likely that you're going to have like not fresh food.
Yeah. And so my thing was always, we are serving the children healthy snacks, but I am not going to require the parents or the school to budget extra money for organic food. And I still remember one mom just just talking to me and saying, you know, and I really, really hope you never serve goldfish crackers at this school because we are a goldfish free household. And she said it with such seriousness. I almost died. There would be moments where I don't know how I'd not laugh if they happened to me now. And I don't know how I did it sometimes, but she was so serious with saying that she had a goldfish free household, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but to define yourself by that. There was another parent in this same school tour with us, and it was a dad, and he just looked at the floor at that moment, and I just was not going to make any eye contact because it would have been really unprofessional because I would have laughed. But this is, I mean, and not to make light of people's food fears, but it felt like first world problems sometimes though.
Oh, well, for sure. I mean, that seems to be the GMO argument in a nutshell. In many ways, it is a first world problem. And again, like, I think educating the public about why choosing GMO-free foods can be dangerous for the marketplace, and about the fact that there is no evidence to support the idea that you should avoid GMO foods is one thing. I think that's important, but of course people are going to make their own decisions. But the minute that they start trying to make decisions for other people, that's when I get really upset about it. It's like, yeah, if you want to have your first world problems and you want to make these decisions for your family based on woo-woo nonsense, that's one thing. But you want to affect other people's families, that's like a little bit beyond the pale.
Yeah, I mean, and that's where I've talked a lot with the women in the film, and Coven did an awesome talk at QED back in October about how the GMO issue is a social justice issue, because by making decisions, you know, over here based on the wooey nonsense, we're having this impact on ideas about food, and we're affecting people getting access to food in other parts of the world. Like, because by demonizing the technology, it's hindering progress in places that can really benefit from it. So I feel like sometimes, you know, getting so caught up in the first world problems here and just kind of forgetting that our attitudes about things do have a trickle down impact on other places. That's the part that makes me want to continue talking about this stuff and advocating for it, because I think we just need a little bit more awareness about the fact that, you know, there is technology out there that can have a bigger global impact. There was a really good opinion piece, I think, in the Washington Post recently about how the GMO issue, avoiding GMOs. I think they said it's not just anti-science, it's immoral, was essentially the gist of the piece, but that there's a lot that can be done to kind of help on a larger scale, but we're maybe holding it back a little bit by, you know, giving into the fear and misinformation on these topics.
I think one thing that really frustrates me is that when you actually sit down face to face with somebody who's anti-GMO, and of course, there's a lot of people here in Los Angeles, there's a lot of people who I'm quite close to who are very, very bright people, their motivation is actually not connected to genetic modification. It's not connected to transgenic biotechnology. It's connected to the same kinds of food justice concerns. It's connected to the idea of multinational corporations owning patents on certain types of foods. And really, when it comes down to it, there's a kernel or a core of actually interesting ethical debate that can be had. And it's unfortunate to me, and it's sad, because I think that the baby is often thrown out with the bathwater, and this kind of conflation of issues really causes an actually important conversation to be swept under the rug, instead of this conversation that everybody's having about how Monsanto is evil because they modify plants. And it's like, no, that's not the problem. That's not a problem at all. Yet that's the conversation that so many people want to have. And I don't know still to this day if it's because genetic modification seems to exist only in large companies because it is so expensive to get a GM plant to market, or if it's because genetic modification by its very concept is confusing for people to understand, or because it's very new and it's very scary to people, you know, the idea of Frankenfoods. I don't know where a lot of the fear mongering comes from. I think it must be a mix of all of it, but it bums me out that people end up being upset about what I think is the wrong thing to be upset about.
Yeah. And it is this conflation, like you said, with the technology and the, you know, the impacts it can have, and then just the corporate aspect of it. Monsanto isn't biotechnology and that's it. And that's the issue. And that's what's so tricky about all of this, is that if only we could sort of isolate the idea of the technology and really be able to show people the positive impact it can have and say, but we don't always need to talk about Monsanto when you talk about GMO. It's and that's what, that is the part that is just, that's frustrating, but is that also then motivation to do more, like, you know, make the Science Moms movie or talk about these topics on podcasts or have, I mean, when we did the panel at SciCon after we showed the film, you know, something that we were kind of talking about is that, yeah, we were kind of preaching to the choir there. We had a room of 500 skeptics that understood, you know, where we're coming from, and probably for the most part were pro biotechnology and all of that. But I think that because there is so much conflation and confusion and all of this around GMOs and all of that, is that it's sort of the responsibility of everyone to not be so silent about these issues if you have a positive feeling about them too. I mean, it's easy to talk about things that we're mad about, but sometimes, you know, we just kind of are quiet. And I wonder in some sense if the biotech stuff just, you know, continues to have the bad reputation, because, you know, those of us who know that it's, that, you know, GMOs are safe according to the research that's out there, maybe we don't speak up as much as the people who are just, you know, going off the myths.
It's hard too, because we, like, the minute we do speak up, people call us shills, and then we have to fight against that too. And it's like, ah, it's so frustrating. I sometimes think an interesting approach, and I know that you guys do this, and I know a lot of people who are more forward thinking do this, but is to really talk about the benefits. Like, why do we modify the genes of these organisms? What are we attempting to achieve? Is it to prevent a catastrophic disease? Is it to make sure that they don't get eaten alive by pests so they can actually make it to your plate? I think, unfortunately, sometimes that's the stuff that's unseen. It's happening not behind closed doors. It's happening out in the open, but it's happening before it ever makes it to the grocery store. And so a lot of people just don't understand the amount of work that goes into farming and the amount of technique that goes into getting that, you know, tomato or that banana or whatever into the grocery store. It's like it just exists the minute it's in the grocery store. That's where it first was born. You know what I mean? And so having the conversation about what happens, you know, having a stronger relationship with our food, I do think is important, but maybe sometimes taking it beyond the idea of pest control or disease control and talking about, like, the new Arctic apple, right? It doesn't brown, and that's amazing, and it can save so much time and so much money for so many moms for their kids' lunches. But the problem is, you say that to somebody, dude, this apple doesn't brown, how great is that? And they go, oh my gosh, that sounds horrible, that sounds so unnatural. And you're like, yeah, but you feed your kids like mac and cheese that has powdered cheese in it, and that's, like, you know, like, how does that not scare you? And I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the fact that we've dominated cheese and figured out how to powder it, and now we can reconstitute it with milk. That's amazing. But, like, why is that any different than an apple that doesn't brown?
Yeah, well, and that's the thing. It's this super cool life hack for parents, you know, that you can throw some apple slices in your child's lunchbox the night before. Because I'm like, I'm doing a commercial for Arctic Apples here. So if they want to give me an endorsement deal or something, that'd be cool. But
chill! But,
oh, I've been called that. Oh, actually, I was called a shill in conjunction with Arctic Apples once because someone from Arctic Apples tweeted a picture of the Science Moms panel at SciCon. So we were being talked about by a corporation. Like, it's so, it's laughable and ridiculous. But Arctic Apples, if you're listening to this, I would love a sample. But anyways, but it's this cool thing that, I mean, I know for me, it's way easier to pack my kids' lunches the night before instead of when I'm like dragging in the morning. So I don't pack them apples though, because if I cut those up the night before, they, Milo and Zeke would probably just send it back home. Like, Mom, what are you doing?
And like, you can buy the ones that are pre-sliced and have like the preservatives, like the lemon juice or whatever on them. And they're sealed in individual packs, but they cost like 10 times as much as just buying a fresh apple.
And they taste a little weird. They have that like slight funky taste, but what I like, so I'm just stoked that there is the technology to develop these kind of cool non-browning apple slices. And also though, when you think about it too, if I were to slice up apples and then they brown and my kids send them back in their lunchbox, we've just wasted food.
Yeah. And we already do that so much.
Yeah, we do. And so that's why these little life hack things are pretty cool. And so, yeah, why not talk about these things? But then, yes, of course, there's the inevitable, like you said, well, it's not natural. But when you think about our food, I mean, what does natural even mean anymore? Like, there are things that were, you know, the person who said that the apple isn't natural probably would serve their child an organic mac and cheese, as long as that powdered cheese is organic.
Yeah, it's like the same thing. That's so weird. It's such a disconnect.
And so that's where our culture has just absorbed these words, natural, organic, whatever, and given them this sanctimonious, I don't know, type of
power,
value to them. Yeah. And so that's the non-GMO project, butterfly label. You know, if you see that on something, somehow it means that it's good.
All right, guys, I want to take a quick moment to thank the sponsors of this week's episode, starting with The Great Courses Plus. I'm really honored to be partnering with The Great Courses Plus because I really think that we're a match made in heaven between this amazing service and Talk Nerdy. When you sign up for The Great Courses Plus, you can keep learning about new science every day because there are thousands of topics, and it doesn't just have to be science. There are professors teaching courses on psychology, philosophy, mathematics, photography, anything that you can think of. And they're the world's leading professors and experts. There are literally thousands of topics. But this week, I want to recommend to you Dr. Robert Sapolsky's course, Being Human, Lessons from the Frontiers of Science. Now, if you remember, I had Dr. Sapolsky on the show just before the break, and he has such great insight into what makes human beings tick. I mean, he's a neuroendocrinologist and a primatologist who has a really deep understanding of evolution and of the human brain. And so he helps us understand how we're similar, but also very different from other species, and the ways that we do make our biology work for us. Now, you can watch this series and so many more from any TV, from your laptop, from your tablet, or from your smartphone. And the really cool thing is you can just listen along with the Great Courses Plus app, kind of podcast style. So guys, you know, I want to keep the Great Courses Plus as a sponsor on the show. I think we can keep this relationship going for a long time, but you know what that means you have to do. You've got to sign up. You get a free trial to learn about anything, but you have to use my special URL for the show, okay? It's thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. One more time for your free trial, go to thegreatcoursesplus.com/nerdy. I also want to thank Simple Contacts for their support of the show. You may not know this, but when I'm not wearing glasses, I have to wear contacts because sometimes when I'm on TV, I have to read the teleprompter and I cannot see it without vision correction. And I'll tell you what, I hate going to the doctor to renew my prescription. That's why I was so excited to try Simple Contacts for the first time. It's a great new app that makes that process simple. It lets you renew your prescription and reorder your brand of lenses from anywhere in just minutes. It actually brings the doctor's office to your home. There's a vision test online that's designed by doctors, and every test is carefully reviewed by an ophthalmologist. But no, the Simple Contacts vision test isn't a replacement for your periodic full eye health exam. You still have to make sure that your blinkers are working well. They offer an amazing selection with every brand of lenses, and their prices are really hard to beat. And get this, the eye exam is only $30. Plus, they offer free shipping. And I'm telling you, the process is super easy. I was able to order my prescription in minutes, and I was kind of surprised, I think, that it wasn't more of a hassle. I had been putting it off for a long time, but when I sat down to do the process on Simple Contacts, I was in and out and really pleased with how fast the shipping was. So get this, guys. This is the best part. You get $30 off of your first Simple Contacts order, and you've just got to go to simplecontacts.com/nerdy and enter the promo code nerdy at checkout. Again, $30 off your first order with free shipping. That's simplecontacts.com/nerdy, and the promo code is nerdy. You can thank me later. All right, guys, let's get back to the show. This is the part I don't understand about the Label It people, because I'm like, everything that's non-GMO is already labeled because it's a good marketing ploy. Like, those companies aren't labeling the food because they themselves are anti-GMO. I don't know where I sit on this. And it's been a topic of contention for me simply because some of the people that I advertise with have gone into this world of non-GMO, and it frustrates me. But at the same time, it's like part of me doesn't blame them because I know they probably did it because they make more money doing it that way. And it sucks, but I feel like it's the consumer. It's the basic consumer. It's the choices that we're making that are driving these different companies to do things like label their food anti-GMO. It's the same thing as when you see a pasta sauce or like a bag of nuts and it says gluten-free on it. You're like, yeah, obviously there's no wheat in nuts. What are you talking about? But they do it because A, if somebody is celiacs, they want them to know that they're not going to get sick using their product. And B, so many people are gluten-free just because it's trendy that they're like, well, whatever, if I slap that label on, it costs me almost nothing and I might make more money.
No, it's absolutely like a logical thing for companies to do. I used to be an avid subscriber to a meal delivery service. And then one day, and this is after, I think, 2 years of using it, one day I opened the box and happened to read on the box that they have a non-GMO commitment or there's no GMO ingredients or whatever. And I ended up like writing blog posts and the company contacted me. And
so what happened from that? Did they understand where you were coming from?
So this is what kind of bummed me out, is that they know that GMO isn't bad. And so what kind of bummed me out is that I was having a conversation with somebody who was clearly scientifically literate about this issue, yet at the same time was just, this is what we're doing because it's what people want. And so, and I was trying to come at it from the angle of, well, there's a whole other population of people, you know, like myself, like the people who commented on the company's Facebook page and on my blog post saying, we have canceled our subscription with you now. And all, like, the blog post got a lot of reads.
Yeah. But the problem is we're still a fraction compared to probably the subscribership. You know what I mean?
Totally. And so, yeah. So what I kind of said to them was like, maybe you want to try to be a little bit different. Not that they were going to listen to me. Like, who am I in this whole thing?
Well, but I do think it's important to have that conversation get started, because now the thing is, companies are aware of that. I think that every time a company makes a GMO-free commitment, because they know that it's going to affect their bottom line, and of course their corporations, their responsibility, yes, in some respects, is to provide, like, their responsibility is to the consumer in the sense that they can't, like, make them sick. They need to, like, serve FDA-approved food and all of that. But their responsibility really is to make money. They're a business. That's their basic, you know, drive. And so I think that if they actually listen to these individual complaints, any company, like an orange juice company that says we use GMO-free oranges, like, if they listen, maybe they will start to at least think about it. And I think change is affected slowly, but it does have to start somewhere. And so I think it's important, you know, the activism aspect of the work that you do is important, because until they're made aware of it, they may not even know.
Yeah. And I remember a conversation I had with, I think I called, I haven't done this too many times, but I think I called, maybe it was Nestle or one or some other big company at one point when I saw that they were going to be going non-GMO or whatever it was. But I remember the person I spoke to on the phone, again, echoed what the, you know, the meal delivery company said, and that they know what the science on this is and all of that. But she said, very plainly to me, she said, you know, the people that call and contact us are not the people like you. She said she appreciated hearing from me just because it was different than the people that contact them on the anti side of things. So that's kind of what I, you know, was getting to before, is that any little bit of a voice that we can have, I think helps. Because I think part of this is shifting the narrative around these topics and shifting the way people collectively think about these things. And so it, you know, these little conversations might not affect change immediately, but it's planting seeds as much as possible about these things.
And the truth is, like, I think that when you look at the population as a whole, or maybe, you know, there's different ways to define the population that we're talking about, but maybe we'll talk about the American population for right now, which is, you know, on a general scale, a relatively privileged population. But the truth is, we have a lot of people within our borders that struggle. We have a lot of people living below the poverty line, and we have a lot of people who don't actually have access to healthy food. You know, we have people who live in quote unquote food deserts, whose only option to buy food is from, like, liquor stores and bodegas. So we're not immune to that issue. But I do think it's interesting when you look at different topics that there are movements, and then there is kind of just the general consensus of people who maybe don't have the energy or the attention to think too deeply about these issues. So I think when it comes to vaccines, there's a small, powerful anti-vax movement that's starting to affect change. But for the most part, people vaccinate their kids. Like, most people know that vaccines are important. Most people vaccinate their kids. It's actually against the law in many places not to, or at least you can't bring your kids to a public school if you don't. Whereas with the GMO thing, I think, I don't know, but it seems like it's, if not 50-50, it errs on the side of anti-GMO. And so I feel like that's where maybe, I don't know, we could really make a little bit more headway with the work that we're doing.
Yeah, I mean, that is definitely what it seems like to me, in terms of even opinion polls or whatever, when you look at, like, Pew Research polls and things about public attitudes towards GMOs compared to what the scientific consensus is and all that kind of stuff. It does seem like it's at least sort of maybe a slight tip towards the anti side of things. And so that's why, you know, when I do the work I do in trying to reach out to parents, and you think about, you know, the moms and dads who are going to the store to buy food for their families, if they had a little bit more information about, like, does this butterfly on the package actually mean anything that will improve the health of my children? If they have a little bit more accessible information about that, then maybe public attitudes could shift a little bit.
And the truth is, like, almost every other aspect, if you were to make, like, a matrix of decision making, like a decision making tree, I mean, to me, something that's one of the most powerful ways that I make a decision is based on budget. And so if I have an organic apple next to a GMO-free non-organic apple next to, which of course organic means GMO-free. So a GMO-free organic apple, a GMO-free non-organic apple, and then a conventionally grown apple, the conventionally grown apple is always going to be less expensive. And right there, I'm going to be more motivated to choose that. And so I feel like sometimes we need to, instead of as the skeptics be like the poo-pooers, we need to be the ones who are framing things in the positive. Like, look at the benefits of buying conventionally grown food. Look at the jobs we're giving people. Look at the money that we save. Look at that. Like, instead of always going, the thing you think makes it better because it's GMO-free or organic is not actually making it better, we should say, look at what does make it better when it's not organic.
Exactly. Frame it in the way of how it could, I mean, it helps anybody if they can go to the grocery store, buy healthy food, and save money that they would have spent on the more expensive version of the same thing. And so, you know, as far as parents go, you're saving money while still feeding your children a nutritious diet. And how great is that? And then you're not having to worry as much that you're doing something bad by making the less expensive decision. Like, it's a win for everybody. So it's about framing these things and trying to, I think, alleviate some of the fear in the process of doing that.
And what you mentioned about Coven, who of course has been on the podcast before when she was giving a talk about food justice and social justice, I think it's so important because there's the aspect, first of all, of food justice from a purely economic standpoint, right? That people who are struggling with insecurity need to be able to have access to healthy food so that they're not feeding their children low nutrition, high calorie food, contributing to obesity, but also to malnutrition at the same time. You know, that like paradox that we have in our country of people who are obese yet don't have basic macronutrients or micronutrients in their food. So there's that aspect, but there's also what I like to think of as kind of like the psychological injustice, which is that poor people oftentimes are hit with the double whammy because there's the shame that comes along with not being able to afford what they think of or what society has made everybody think of as the better option or the healthier option. So if we can reframe it, and this isn't marketing for the sake of marketing, this is marketing to reflect reality. But if we can reframe it that sometimes or oftentimes the healthier or the equivalently healthy option is the conventionally grown option, we can empower people to have more, I think, improved mental health about their choices as well.
Well, yeah, because when you think about probably the impact of parental stress on just quality of life of a family, I mean, we want to improve that. And what you're saying is helping frame these issues in a way that makes people feel confident in their decisions. I mean, that's the goal too, because yeah, we're talking about nutrition and health, but I think we really need to continue to have as many conversations about just quality of life and mental health type of issues too, and how all of these things can be connected.
Absolutely. So what are some of the other things, right? I'm not a mom, so like I only really have to worry about myself. And of course, you know, I'm concerned about my friends and my family and my dog, who is basically my child, which I know it's not the same thing. I think it's rude when people say it is. But I don't know what kinds of issues, especially within the skeptical movement, like what kinds of issues you're often struggling with trying to be a skeptical thinker and trying to care for your little ones. Like what other things that are maybe not even, I know food is an obvious one, like food and health, because that's what moms are like neurotically concerned about when they first have kids. Like, of course, you want to make sure your kids are healthy and well nourished. Like you can't let your kid die. Like you have to feed your kid.
Yeah, you have to keep them alive. I mean, you essentially come home from the hospital with this small creature that you are tasked with keeping alive. And so, yeah, there's those sort of basic things that are not so basic because you are in charge of, the life of this small human. But then you get into things too, like just wanting them to start to develop into critical thinkers, right? And have, you know, a wealth of experiences, and wanting them to be able to ask questions. And that requires a lot of times being patient enough to give them answers or help them find answers. And, you know, it's the stuff, yeah, that goes beyond just the basics of day-to-day keeping them alive. It's helping them, you know, giving them as good of a quality of life as you can. But also, I mean, for me, it's wanting to help them develop the tools that they need to kind of navigate this world. And sometimes it's about having conversations that aren't easy. I mean, when, you know, when a 4-year-old asks you, like, where did Grammy's dog go? You know, well, Connie died. And I mean, I've had those conversations with them about death. And also, as an atheist, there's that aspect of the conversation too. So I know this is kind of definitely outside of my, like, the topics I cover in the Science Moms film, but yeah, these are things that I do think about as a parent in the sort of skeptic atheist type of worlds, that I want to help them know how to ask questions and come to, you know, sort of reasonable evidence-based answers, but just, I don't know, like, also encourage them to be able to express whatever they're feeling at the moment too. So it's that balance of wanting to help them navigate the world and not totally sugarcoat things, but also make things feel good. And it's treading that line, right? Of their kids, but you know, like I will admit they believe in Santa.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that because, like, I'm lucky. My dog doesn't believe in Santa, so I don't have to tell him one day that he's not real. But I was always wondering how I would handle that, because it's not just about your kid. Now it's about the fact that your kid goes out into public, your kid goes to school, and you don't want to ruin it for everybody else. Like, there are social conventions that I guess are not very skeptical, but I guess the Santa one doesn't bug me as much, because, like, if your kid was like 14 and still believed in Santa, like, that would be a problem. You know what I mean? But when a 7-year-old believes in Santa, you know, in the back of your head that, like, one day he's going to come to the understanding like all other kids do. And that's sort of a rite of passage.
Yeah. And that's kind of like my view on Santa. And this is probably me rationalizing it to myself a little bit, is Santa the first exercise in skepticism for my children? Because there's going to be a point where they are starting to wonder, how can this dude do all this stuff in this one night? Or they're going to see, like, the wrapping paper that Santa used or some, you know, something, and they will deduce this on their own. But yeah, part of my Santa thing right now is kind of like you said, I don't want them to be the kids that go to preschool and say, "Mommy is Santa," or something like that.
Ruin it for everybody else.
I'm not trying to raise two little buzzkills right now. So I'm just kind of letting the Santa thing happen. I wouldn't say that I am really active in talking about it, but right now, I mean, honestly, it was just Christmas. Seeing how stoked they were just about Christmas, and in general, it warmed my heart. So I'm gonna just kind of go with the Santa stuff for now. And I know it's probably, you know, I'm contradicting myself and whatever it, when I say that and then talk about how we had a conversation about the dog dying and, you know, the dog got buried and that's literally it. Or that, their great grandfather died and that's it. And so I had those conversations, and then one day Milo, the older one, came home and said, when he said something about a friend at school, said, "When people die, they go to heaven." And I was just thinking to myself, oh, damn it. But I said, I think I told him at that point, I was like, well, you know, that's what your friend believes. And I kind of said, and I told you, you know, I told you what happens, but if that's what your friend believes, like, that's what he believes.
That's a tough one, right? Because in my view, Santa and Jesus are different because everybody grows up. No adults that are like reasonable adults believe in Santa, but the, you know, religion myths are more pernicious. They persist into adulthood, which is dangerous. It can be really problematic. And so I understand the need to kind of not put the kibosh on it, but at least be more mindful of that. Also, the problem with the Santa myth is that, like, and the reason that I think it's important to find a good balance between sort of pragmatism and idealism is that, you know, you can be an idealist all you want and be super militant about this and say, like, my kids would never believe in Santa and we're going to be the most, you know, skeptical family and blah, blah, blah. But the truth is, like, you live in the real world and the Santa myth is everywhere.
And that's why I just kind of figured this is my one right now that I'm letting it go. I dig Christmas. I like it. And so I'm just rolling with it with the kids. And, you know, when they start to ask those questions and start to figure it out on their own, I will encourage that process. But for now, while they are kind of into the magic of it all, I'm down with letting that continue. But yeah, when the more religion based questions came up, I just answered those pretty straightforwardly with them, like, you know, guys, that's it.
Absolutely. And there is no handbook. And you have to do it the way you do it, you know? It's like you make it your own and there's really no right and wrong. There's what's right for you. I think that's the most important thing.
With parenting, I have this, when I've given a talk a couple times, I have this slide with a coffee mug that just says world's okayest mom on it. And I think that that's kind of all we can do is our best, because we need to do, I mean, every day is a new adventure with children and we want to do our best to keep them as cool and happy and thriving as possible, but also remember to be good to ourselves and not be too hard on ourselves either in the process.
Absolutely. Ugh. And it's, you know, that's a tall order, but it's so important. I mean, that's not the only reason, but that's part of the reason that I do not tread in this area at all. And I feel like I respect and really admire my friends who have kids, but I don't always envy them. We'll put it that way.
I feel you. And I'm a parent myself. So yeah.
So I gotta ask, you know, we've been chatting for about an hour already, and I would hate to not ask you the same questions that I ask everybody at the end of the podcast. So I would love your take on what have become now my kind of semi-famous closing questions. The first one is, of course, when you think about the future in whatever context is relevant to you right now, you know, it's the new year. You may have really big global issues on your mind, or you may have very personal issues on your mind. But number one, what is the thing that keeps you up the most at night? What are you most kind of concerned about, worried about, preoccupied with? And then on the flip side of that, what are you really optimistic and hopeful and excited about?
Ooh, you know what's weird is you ask me that and I have been sleeping really well lately. So maybe I don't know if this is just kind of different, but I feel like lately I've just, when I'm thinking at night before I go to bed, and this is weird because I like run a nihilist meme page and I can be really cynical, but I feel hopeful for my own life. Like my own personal stuff feels like it's coming together really nicely. And I think I'm just still riding a little bit of the science mom's high of the fact that like we have this thing out in the world that maybe can make a positive impact. And so I guess the thing that keeps me up at night is like, what's next? You know, what can we collectively do, whether it's like me and the science moms or me and Dan with our podcast or just the kind of SciComm skeptic world in general, to keep getting these messages out there and, you know, like the lofty goal of making the world a better place. So in the same vein, I think I'm hopeful that we can do some good together. And that's, you know, people actually working together. So I guess the thing that keeps me up and the thing that I feel most hopeful about are all sort of one and the same.
I love that. I think it's also not uncommon that those two things are sort of two sides of the same coin.
Yeah.
Well, Natalie, thank you so much for joining me today. It was a lot of fun, and I feel like I learned an awful lot. Before we go, please let everybody know, A, where they can see your work, where they can hear your podcast, where they can find the Science Moms documentary, and where they can just generally keep up with all the cool stuff you're doing.
Okay, so there is sciencemomsdoc.com. That's the website for the film, and you can, you know, find all the social media on there too. I do the Science Enthusiast podcast. That's on iTunes and wherever podcasts are available. And I'm on Twitter at NC Newell. And yeah, I think that that's about it. But I'm so glad I got to talk to you again. You were on my podcast, I think it was last year. And so it was nice to talk to you.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for joining me, and everybody listening, thank you for coming back week after week. I'm really looking forward to the next time we all get together to talk nerdy.